So good to be back with you for another GoldSeek.com Radio Gold Nugget segment. Today's special guest, Dr. Stephen Lieb, author of the bestseller, Red Alert. Dr. Stephen Lieb has over a quarter century of investment experience, author of seven bestsellers, including The Oil Factor, The Coming Economic Collapse, and Game Over, his latest Red Alert, How China's Growing Prosperity Threatens the American Way of Life. Welcome back, Dr. Lieb.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's always a pleasure.
Start off today with some of the topicality. For instance, there's been, well, the geopolitical situation, at least for a while, was red hot.
Obviously, you have I think they call it a caliphate or caliphate or however you pronounce it, that is now occupying about a third of Iraq and, you know, a big chunk of Syria. It appears, you know, they're extremists to the extreme, every bit as extreme as Al-Qaeda, of which they're an offshoot, and they're self-financing, and it's clear that they have their eyes set on places like Saudi Arabia. They're Sunni, and the Saudis are Sunni. And the Saudis are a bifurcated society. About two-thirds of the Saudis are wealthy. Another third are Sunnis and not very wealthy. So they're in a position to recruit and to make a lot of trouble in a lot of the Middle East. And it would be very silly to take these people as, just another threat. Basically, America has said they're not going to put feet on the ground or foot boots on the ground, and airstrikes are not, you know, they may contain them to some extent, but they're not going to diminish their recruiting efforts. If anything, they may strengthen their recruiting efforts. And I think our response to the crisis so far, arming the so-called Syrian rebels, is ridiculous. I mean, it's just like, it's like we're trying to beat ourselves. I mean, you're arming pharmacists and proprietors of dry cleaning shops, et cetera, and these weapons are almost surely going to end up in the hands of the militants. So I think there is a lot to worry about geopolitically. The fact that it hasn't yet hurt oil prices and that commodities have been under some pressure, you know, this doesn't mean too much. I mean, this is a world, and it's always been the stock market and the world we've been in for a long time, at least in most of my lifetime, has always been a world that can change dramatically. Markets can change dramatically. I won't say overnight, but they can change dramatically in a very, very short period of time. So I think it's a mistake to write off, what's happening in the Middle East as not, you know, important geopolitically. It is. It's exceptionally important. If this group of militants can start recruiting Sunnis from, you know, all parts of the Middle East, it could be very, very important. And I just don't see any real hope of gathering a Middle East army against them. I mean, they represent, you know, the same kinds of thinking that a lot of Middle Easterners believe in, unfortunately, very unfortunately. And I just don't think that we get it. I really don't. I don't think you're going to see the Turks fighting against them. I don't think you're going to see any real boots on the ground. I think that, you know, what we're doing with airstrikes is about what we're going to end up doing, and I don't think that's really going to stop them, unfortunately.
I know that listeners will want to hear the panacea that you are proposing that is contrary to our officials' current plan of action.
My panacea would be probably feet on the ground, boots on the ground, but unfortunately, it may be too late in the day. I mean, we sort of wasted that alternative when we went into Iraq the first time. Our panacea right now, I mean, I wouldn't call it a panacea, is to keep our fingers crossed, toes crossed, and everything crossed, that Iraq can form a government and that government can run an army. But that's really a long shot, because you're asking a government that's headed by a Shiite to unite a country that is filled with very, very strong beliefs that, of which, you know, only part are Shiites. You need Sunnis and you need Kurds behind you, and it's going to be very, very difficult to, you know, have a united government. under those conditions. But that has to be the panacea. Whatever we can do to, you know, forward that, that would be great. If the Iraqi army is able to, you know, be a real force against this collection of militants, that would be great. But other than that, I think that's, last I heard, that the new government, they finally have gotten rid of Maliki, thank goodness, but the new government is headed by a bright guy. There's no doubt about it, but they still don't have a defense minister. Now, how are you going to fight a war without a defense minister? I mean, it strikes me that's a pretty important position to fill. You know, I'm not saying it looks hopeless at this point, but it doesn't look great. I mean, you know, panacea would be further protection, further monies to help the Saudis along in terms of protecting their assets. But my gosh, how much more money can we give them? I mean, you know, it's just not a good situation, and it's a situation that I think people have to be aware of. In the sense that it can change, it could change overnight, or not overnight, but over a period of not too long a period, it could change and, you know, change for the worse.
Don't you feel that our allies, however weak those ties may have become in recent decades due to our own actions, at least partially, the concerted, unified action to stabilize the Middle East? I mean, for instance, one of our top allies, Israel, could be jeopardized if this situation becomes even more unstable.
Israel's very worried about this. I mean, they've said as much. I mean, they said this is one of the reasons that they're not going after Hamas as aggressively as they were, because this is a threat. It's a threat to the entire Middle East. There's no doubt about it. Look, the Middle East is a highly fractured place. I mean, you know, the Arab Spring, I mean, you know, it proves it, the failure of it. And now you have this group springing up that, you know, controls vast amounts of territory, self-funding, and has aspirations that, you know, basically include everything. So it's you know, what can Israel do? I mean, you know, not a whole lot, and I haven't even mentioned Iran. I mean, you know, the Iranians would be a natural foe to these people because the Iranians are Shiites, and these people are Sunnis. And the Iranians, you know, they could do something. If their feet were on the ground and they were marching with the Iraqis, that would mean something. But the Iranians, in my opinion, and I think they've said as much already, would want, they basically would want permission, de facto, that's what they're saying. They're not saying it in so many words, but they're saying it in effect, they want permission to build a nuclear bomb in order to help with these people. So, I mean, you know, talk about being caught between a rock and a hard place. There you are. I mean, do you let the Iranians build a nuclear bomb so that they'll help you, maybe help you against this group of militants? Or do you just let the group of militants run on and hope that the Iraqis themselves can assemble an army? And, you know, let's not forget, and you mentioned Israel before. I mean, I think that Israel, if they sense that the Iranians were building a nuclear bomb, I think they take action. This is not something that has simple solutions. There are no simple solutions. There are no panaceas. This is a long time in the making, and it's a pox on a lot of people's houses, not just Bush, but a lot of people, not just Obama, but a lot of people. There's been, you know, a lot of drop balls here. Their deal with us is that they won't. I don't think that Iran, despite all their flamboyant protestations, et cetera, is really so much interested in Europe or interested in Israel. I think they're much more interested in Saudi Arabia.
Ah.
And I think that, you know, a nuclear-armed Iran would, you know, basically make them, you know, king of the Middle East. So, I mean, would you rather have Iran or would you rather have this militant group? Now, if Iran did become nuclear armed, then I think you'd have Israel dropping tactical nuclear weapons to try and destroy the Iranian nuclear capacity. And, you know, then that just becomes a holy mess of all sorts. You know, it's just terrible. I mean, I wish I could put a better spin on it, but you know, this is why I advise, or one of the reasons I advise almost everybody, or everybody, in fact, not almost everybody, but anyone that, you know, can, that I think they've got to have precious metals, gold, et cetera, in their portfolios. I think it's an absolute necessity, Chris. Absolute necessity. And we're not even talking about the role Russia plays with Iran. Russia has a major role in the Iranian nuclear plans. I mean, they're the ones that supply Iran. And, you know, the United States is basically, its hegemony is a thing of the past. That's the bottom line here. There's no doubt about it in my mind. I mean, even militarily, as we're talking now, what we're talking now is basic geopolitical military terms and how helpless the United States is in the face of this situation. And the country that I think emerges kind of unharmed here and in a very, very much stronger position than they've ever been is China. That spells gold standard to me. You know, I know I'm jumping around a little bit here, but it's all the more reason for investors to hold precious metals. I mean, yeah, they've been disappointing. And, gosh, I mean, I started writing a publication. I think the first issue was around 1978. I think the Dow was around 800 at that time. And, you know, all I could say is that there's no downside in this market. And basically I was right, but I said there's massive upside, but I couldn't say when. And, you know, it took 4 years, but I was right. I was right. So, I mean, I think in gold, there's as much upside in gold as there was in the Dow when it was at 800. Literally, I think gold could go up 10 or 15 fold because you're going to have to, you know, whatever currency, however it's used, there's going to have to be enough of it in value to back up all international trade, and that takes you 10 or 15 times higher than what it is today. Then you might be able to, you know, get somewhere in the world, because then all of a sudden, you know, you're talking about actors, becomes much broader, becomes in, yeah, I mean, you have a much broader range of players to choose from. It's not like the United States on its own, which is really the case today. It could be the United States, China, Russia, who knows? Everybody could be on their own, but it would be under a different kind of monetary regime and a different kind of worldwide regime, and one in which China, I think, might play the prominent part. That's where I think we're headed.
You brought up some great points, and you talked about the precious metals. But, you know, the investment du jour is still equities and bonds.
It was in 2007, too. And, you know, and it may remain the, you know, look, I'm not bearish on stocks at all here. I think stocks will go higher. And you know, my perspective here is not, you know, 2 or 3 months. It really is, you know, the next several years. So, yeah, I totally agree that the investment du jour is, in fact, stocks, and I think it's likely to remain stocks for some time to come. But that does not in any way mean that in 5 years stocks are going to be higher than they are today and gold's going to be, you know, lower. No, I think that if your perspective is a little bit longer term, you really want to talk about precious metals and gold.
Absolutely, and of course that's music to the ears of our listeners. But at the same time, I think for 5 years now, since, as you mentioned, the bottom there, the nadir of the bear market, the Great Recession, stocks just simply have chugged along. And we have seen, as I'm sure you know, an awful lot of stock repurchases by top corporations, and this reduces the supply. They're buying back their own shares, supporting their stock price. This has been a theme that we've seen. We see a very robust IPO market. You know, the Alibaba, just one of the latest and a long litany of companies to go public with success. And I guess you can really look at it from two perspectives, can't you? I mean, these are the hallmarks of a bull market, but they can also be viewed as, from a contrarian perspective, as a bit frothy. What's your take?
I'm not I don't think anything's happening here that's frothy. I'm not bearish on the market at all here. In fact, I would say I'm kind of bullish on the market, but I'm talking longer term. You know, sometimes, very rarely are there bells and whistles to tell you that the market's going to go down 30 or 40 or 50%. I don't think that's around the corner right now. I think that I would be a little bit concerned about bonds. I think they're getting a little bit frothy here, but I think that, you know, stocks can go higher. I mean, there's massive amounts of money. out there, and I think stocks will go higher. But, you know, you're talking about the geopolitical events and how they're eventually going to play out. I think it's going to end in tears. That's the way I see it. It will, I think, end in tears. And I'm not going to try and time it, but I think that, you know, it will end, and when it ends, it'll end very, very badly. And I think very badly for the U.S., and I think that, you know, from a 5 or 10 year perspective, even less than 10, 5 year perspective, precious metals will dramatically outperform stocks, dramatically, not even in the same ballpark, dramatically.
But, you know, Dr. Lieb, I'm asking guests to prognosticate a bit, keeping in mind the adage, you know, prediction is fraught with difficulties, particularly when it regards the future. Because I think that you have the perspective and the wherewithal to tackle this question. I'd like to know whether or not you view this as the next ultimate zenith. Is this going to be the peak that our progeny looks back in equities, U.S. equities, as that 1929 moment, or perhaps the ultimate zenith?
That comes around to, you know, whether an asteroid's going to strike the Earth. I don't think civilization's going to disappear. But I think that, you know, most historians, I think, would agree that, you know, China's been the number one civilization and economy for 16 out of the last 18 centuries. And I don't think China wants to make it 16 out of 19. So I think that there's been a massive move to the from west to east, and that move is in terms of economic power, in terms of military power, and certainly in terms of, I think, monetary power now. I mean, all the trading in gold is basically going to end up in yuan. So, you know, once China starts, once gold starts being denominated in yuan, and then, you know, the Chinese are in a position to say, well, here we have a currency. We're the biggest trader in the world right now, and now we're going to back our currency up with gold. It's already denominated in yuan. You know, and the dollar is sitting here, you know, where you've got $4 trillion in the Federal Reserve Bank backed up by nothing. And you've got real wages in this country having declined at least since the beginning of this century. Some people argue since 1970. And, you know, basically you have a very, very strong stock market. There's no doubt you do. But I don't think that's going to carry the day. I mean, you know, so what? I mean, you know, you've had a few people get extremely wealthy. I don't think that that's an argument for, you know, a country's infrastructure, a country's ability to, you know, run itself. I mean, our energy policy, I think, is a catastrophe in this country. I don't think we're doing anything with regard to renewable energies to speak of, whereas China, Germany, and other countries are doing much, much, much more. And it's just not a situation that I think can end, you know, well for us. I mean, eventually it may. When you say, is it an ultimate zenith? I think it's going to be a major top. And I think it's going to be a real blow, not just a shot across the bow, but it will hit hard. And I think for a while, America will play second fiddle in the world in a lot of ways. That doesn't mean that we can't come back. I think there's a great spirit that underlies this country. I love this country. But I think that we became way too complacent, and I think we're going to pay for that. That doesn't mean that we're going to pay forever. That doesn't mean that our progeny's progeny are going to look back at these times and say, well, this was the end of America as they knew it. No, I'm not that smart. I can't look that far ahead, but I can say that, you know, we're living through a point of inflection right now. Okay. And it's not too hard to get the stock market to go up when you control money presses. It is hard to get real wages to go up, however, and we're not succeeding there at all. In fact, we're failing miserably. And it's real wages that, you know, is affecting 90-95% of the population. They're not benefiting. So when you say the stock market's going up, to me that's not a good argument for, you know, what's happening in the world today.
Very good. Well, I love to hear that term, inflection point. And another function, another term from calculus, we were talking about how these geopolitical events come together in a single function and affect the markets.
I mean, you know, basically Russia got exactly what they wanted. That was, you know, I think a sign of weakness in the United States. I mean, Russia did exactly what they wanted, really didn't miss a beat doing it. And that's tragic. I mean, it's totally tragic, but they did. And I think the United States facilitated it. I think that basically by, you know, initially supporting the Ukraine, well, we're getting off topic here, but by initially supporting the people in, what, Madden Square, as strongly as they did, I think that they led to the fleeing of the then president of Ukraine and, you know, some sort of chaos, and then that allowed Russia to take over the Crimea, or gave them an excuse to do that. And then, you know, we've tried slapping sanctions on them, and they sort of laughed at those sanctions and slapped their own sanctions. And now what you have is Russia's been free to move their troops into the eastern part of the country, and you'll have some sort of federalism there. And I don't think Russia, I don't think has any plans right now to annex the Ukraine. But, you know, after Obama's, you know, threats once, after the threats following the takeover of the Crimea, it just has to strike you. It's a frisson of fear and agony when you see him in Estonia assuring, you know, this Baltic state that, you know, NATO's behind them. And the Estonians saying, you know, we don't want NATO here. We don't want to tempt the Russians. So, I mean, this is just not the sign of a great power succeeding. This is a sign of a power, you know, basically falling backwards. And then the same power is fighting, you know, this situation in the Middle East, et cetera, while China continues to motor along. So, you know, what more can I say? I wish it were this way.
You seem to imply here that Russia is the biggest victor, but, you know, some of our guests have pointed to the oil companies having, Western oil companies, having infused many of their executives and some of our political leaders into the region, and I'm referring to Ukraine, and how that seems to be a victory on their behalf. Any comments?
Well, Western oil companies, yeah, I mean, they never lose. They're just worldwide oil companies domiciled in the U.S. They're not going to lose. But that's not a victory for the U.S. I mean, that's a victory for, you know, a particular segment of U.S. industry, right? I mean, that's, you know, yeah, they could benefit in certain ways. I don't think they're going to benefit much from being in the Ukraine, but they may benefit. It's hard. The big beneficiary here is obviously China. I mean, you know, the message here to Russia is that you've got to look toward the south, toward your south, or partially south, anyway, toward China, not toward Europe. And that's what they've done. I mean, who knows how much gas and oil they've agreed to send and trade with China. But it's, you know, it's a significant fraction of $1 trillion, if not a trillion. And, you know, at the same time, China's buying Russian gold mines and investing in Russian oil companies. So, you know, the real victor here is not Western oil companies. It's really China.
Very good. Well, let's shift gears back to the precious metals market. And, you know, we've seen some interesting developments in the markets, a lot of weakness lately. And it appears to be setting up a potential capitulation moment, if you will, or a scenario at least where the final holdouts toss up their hands, the weak hands say, I can't take any more pain. And the deep pockets come in and say, okay, this is what we've been waiting for. This is the, as you say, the inflection point. And we see a sea change in sentiment from that point forward. Do you see something like that on the radar screen for us?
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me in any way, shape, or form to see something like that occur. I mean, some sort of, you know, real final shakeout and then, you know, see precious metals come back. What complicates things a little bit here, Chris, is that, you know, we're talking about precious metals as measured in dollars. And, you know, more and more, I think, as I said before, I think they're going to be measured in yuan. So it's going to depend upon, you know, yeah, you might get a shakeout from the dollar holders, but you're certainly not going to get a shakeout from the yuan holders. I mean, you know, they're probably going to buy. So I don't know whether you're going to see some sort of final shakeout or capitulation, or you're going to see something like you saw in 1982 in the stock market. I mean, if you remember back in 1982, I'm sure you don't, you're too young, but I wasn't, and I lived through it, and everybody was looking at, you know, bottoms, 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 and you never got a bottom. And then one day, I think on a Friday or Monday or whatever, market just shot up out of nowhere. I mean, you know, I think Henry Kaufman and Wozenlauer, they changed their view on interest rates or something like that. I mean, it wasn't much of a catalyst, but there was really no capitulation. There could be some capitulation. I'm not ruling it out, but I'm saying that if you're waiting for that moment to invest, don't.
That's interesting, too, because we also saw signs of that in the HGX Philadelphia Housing Index. You know, we had a three-year decline. We may have approached 90% on the downside from peak to trough. Yeah. But then you know what? We never really had anything after that. We had three sine wave years of just consolidation back and forth. And what if we had something similar here in the precious metal?
You hit the nail on the head. I mean, you can't really, you know, describe what a bottom is going to look like. What you can do, I think, with some certainty or some degree of assurance is say that gold, yeah, it could go down a little bit more, maybe another 10% from here. But, you know, the upside is just dramatically higher than the downside. And, you know, the shape and scope of its bottom, I don't think that's the game to play here. I think the game to play here is, again, to recognize the shift in the world from west to east and to know that, you know, the real winning investments in that shift will be precious metals, real objects, commodities, et cetera. Listen, because I do believe in what I'm saying, and I, you know, I'm in this business to try and help people. But
you're not selling anything, and that's what I appreciate. Yeah, you're not pandering to the audience here. You have nothing to gain. Why don't I give you a chance here to give folks your takeaway point?
Well, I think I've shared, you know, most of my, you know, longer-term beliefs. I'm writing a book on, gold-related investments and why I think it's critical to own them. I mean, that book will probably won't be published for at least a year. That's one of my core beliefs. And, you know, I do want to say without any guile whatsoever that I hope that I'm dead wrong, that I hope that, you know, something comes out of the woodwork that I'm completely unaware of and makes me look like an idiot in advocating these kinds of positions because, you know, I don't like it. I don't like to see our country on the edge and between a rock and a hard place and, you know, all those other things that I've said. I don't like saying them. I don't like feeling them. But that basically is what I feel right now. And I think that everybody would be well advised having some gold and other gold correlated investments in their portfolio. How much, you know, that's up to them to decide. But I think it's a very, very good idea to do.
Very good. And do you have any words of wisdom or consolation for those of us who have held out in the silver camp during three brutal years?
Silver will go dramatically higher. I mean, I think silver will outperform gold. I think the recent breakdown in silver was kind of silly. I mean, it went through a support zone and everyone sold. It's ridiculous. There's a company, you know, it's impossible to buy this company, but I look at it from time to time. It's called Giga Solar, and they sell solar panels into China. And they may sell them into other countries, too. But, I mean, they're going gangbusters. So, the demand for silver is there. It's going to increase steadily, industrial demand, that is. And I think that the investment demand is obviously going to increase if I'm right on gold. So, yeah, I think silver is going to probably outperform or at least perform as well as gold, if not outperform gold going forward. So I wouldn't pay too much attention to this recent breakdown in silver. I think it has no meaning whatsoever. This doesn't mean silver can't go to $15, but I mean, I think silver will end up being a three-digit metal, well past $100 in most of our lifetimes. Maybe not mine, but within the next 5 years, I think you'll see silver in three digits.
Well, we certainly hope that that is the case, that you will enjoy many, many decades to come with silver in the triple-digit zone. That's going to please all of us.
Yes, I think you will see that.
Dr. Stephen Lieb, we know your schedule is quite busy and you've been gracious with your time. Oh, and look forward to your wonderful upcoming Precious Metals book. I know listeners will want to get a copy.
As I said, you have about a year or so to wait, but yes. And it's a book like a lot of books I've written. I hope I'm dead wrong. But I don't see anything right now to say I am. So I would, again, advise people to own precious metals and assets that are correlated with precious metals, silver, gold, and, you know, whatever else. Thank you so much, Chris.